I still remember Dr. Hartwell coming to K-State when I was a graduate student over there and giving a distinguished a speech over there. And I was impressed the way he explained the G by E by M interactions. And I had my first lessons from there. So Dr. Hartwell, we are so privileged to have you here and to looking forward to hear from your long, long experience in ET. So even the Fifi experiments, we would read those papers and would be amazed. So it's Dr. Hartwell.
Not sure how I take being referred to as the senior member of the audience. I do want, and you're not going to get a path down models, you're going to get a path down where Cermak is at, is that where we make observations and some of the things that contribute to uncertainty in those observations and why we see different pieces of this. So I really just put this in and talking about variations in the observations that are out there, because often that goes unnoticed and people just take the temperature data and the net radiation and they say, you know, that's just there. And so you're going to get hit up with a little different piece. I want to start it off by this particular aspect and just talk about the fact that in all these different models and everything, we really do have an energy input that's really the net radiation that Ken talked about, and the fact that sometimes we go wrong by assuming that's PAR and not total net in there. And then there's the water vapor gradient, just how quickly does that water move from the evaporating leaf into the atmosphere, or the evaporating soil water evaporation into the atmosphere, driven in lots of different things, both temperature and as well as vapor pressure, and then the wind speed that's out there. And it really becomes that becomes the potential ET. If you look at all the different ET equations, those are the three parameters that just kind of fit in there, and that determines ultimately how much water the atmosphere wants from that surface out there. But the governing fact is the soil water availability. How much do you have in the bank? And that really becomes the interesting piece of this, because as we look across fields, the variation in soil water availability, which is a combination of both the soil water holding capacity and the rooting depth out there, becomes a major limitation in all of this. And when you go back to the first talk and you begin to see just how different soils are across the field, we then want to put that into a single number of ET for a field, which we find that it's not really the case. We have a combined set, but any one spot can become quite different. So, and as I tell producers, that last part out there is you can't deficit spend. Soil water availability in there, you'll run it out to the very wilting point, and then you're not going to borrow against next season, and you're not going to borrow against the next rainfall amount. So that's when the plant begins to really suffer in all of this. The other piece of this is this temperature piece, and I want to reinforce a point that Ken made, because often we take air temperature, and Garrett showed the old cotton shelter piece of this, and we take air temperature, and both from the max and min point of view, and we use that from a weather station nearby, but it's really not the air temperature of that field. Because as you look at the evaporating surface, even if you have a grass surface versus a cotton canopy or soybean canopy or corn canopy, the air temperature is a particular microclimate. And so often biases become in models, and biases become in observations of all of this, because we're not even using the simple right air temperature as part of this overall approach. And that's probably the biggest piece that we have in any of the change that's out there. And so that becomes part of that. If you look at all those feedbacks and you just look at what's going to happen in the future, if we start changing air temperatures, there's increased atmospheric demand and all of this. But I would argue the fact of be very careful about where that air temperature is coming from relative to this. And it's a difference between big fields, small fields, mixed fields, all of these different pieces. Garrett talked about the variations of crops, and when we start getting into small fields, the whole complexity of what that microclimate looks like is much different than that 320 or 480-acre cornfield in central Iowa out there. I'll just walk you through a set of observations that we've made, because we have run multiple site comparisons. And the biggest comparison that we've made is 14 eddy correlation systems across the 10-mile transect in central Iowa, where we have all sorts of different data. We have net radiation. We have all the eddy correlation data. We have soil heat flux data. We've measured LAI, light interception, all those different pieces. And I just want to show you that in one case, in day 179 on corn, and there's very little difference in net radiation in there. It was a nice clear day, obviously, in an unusual day in Iowa to not have any clouds build up. But if you look at this, even from that standpoint, you look in there, and you look, flip it around, and just look at these differences and from the net radiation that really kind of unmask some of these, is that you do find differences between afternoon and morning in terms of net radiation, because there are some differences that occur in these slight pieces that are out there due to things like dew, differences in dew within the field. Another piece that we'll see as we go through this is even differences in cloud cover that are subtle cloud cover that's not even a big piece. Here's the seasonal net radiation values that occur across a number of different sites. And again, in central Iowa, just looking at this, you can see the points go up and down. And what we learn from this is that in reality, when you start looking at 14 different sites across a relatively small area, one of the major differences is cloud cover. Cumulus clouds that build up will cause differences in net radiation that occur instantly across the site. Drop that net radiation down, you see it picked up, and then you see it, those clouds move across, and so you see all this spatial and temporal variation occurring in this. And sometimes we just use, again, a radiometer from a weather station that is much different than the cloud cover that may be even on across in terms of the dynamics of this, particularly if we're doing short scale ET. Now you get into even more variation in LE, and this just happens to be one day again, a fairly clear day, but now we're starting to see all this variation. I'm almost reluctant to use the mouse. not sure what Ken did to it. There we go. You hit it somewhere. Just looking at this, I mean, there's a major differences in CO2 uptake, major differences in, boy, you're right, it is sensitive. Major differences in LE fluxes throughout the middle of the day. Most of this is again, short-term water stress that is imposed by the fact that we had different soils in all these different fields. And so even though net radiation would have said they've been very close, the actual amount that the water vapor is doing in there is coming in. And you see that reflected back in the CO2. So a lot of these things that Ken talks about in terms of the feedback between CO2 and growth and everything else, we see magnified as we go across. And when you start accumulating these up, it really becomes very important. Here's another case in terms of LE and the differences from the average. You do see that here was that purple line at the bottom out there. There's a field of very, very low growth characteristics on this particular day. This was a very poor growing field of soybeans late planted compared to the rest of that was out there. And so serendipity often gives you data that allows you to understand some of the dynamics that are going on in terms of the processes. So what we've learned from this is that variation across these sites have many different scales. And the variation, and when you start looking at uncertainty, is that we have uncertainty in minutes because of cloud cover. And particularly when you get into cumulus cloud cover, the things that pop up and disappear, we have spatial scale and temporal scale and daily because of precipitation. And when we start looking at large scales like watersheds, we actually had a very fortunate event that occurred in this watershed, is that it rained on the western half of the watershed and didn't rain on the eastern half of the watershed. And for the next few days, we had major differences in ET occurring just because of the replenishment of water out there. And so we see that. We also had a difference in dew formation because of that rain that was on one side, not the other. Seasonally, we end up with differences in crop growth, even across this whole watershed, is that these cumulative effects, and they appeared small in what we've shown you there, but cumulative, we really start seeing major differences in water use that are induced by the soil water holding capacity out there. Because that's in the rain-fed agriculture becomes very, very important in all of this. And so these are levels of uncertainty that when we begin to look at the data set become very, very important at how we interpret this, because we tend to think of them as all uniform across very, very large areas, but they're not. And so we see differences among sites that cause the crop growth because of the soil water holding capacity, soil water availability. So you see all this feedback. And when we went to the end of the season and actually collected the yields from the producers, you see that reflected back in the yields that were actually produced out there. So you end up having water become a limitation in all of this. So we begin to learn things, just how important all of this is in terms of the piece of this. What we did both prior to and immediately after this, because of 14 different eddy correlation systems that are out there, is all of them were put in a week-long intercomparison where we ran them over a grass surface. We ran all the net radiometers over grass surface. Big area that we could actually find with grass surface in Iowa so that we could put them all in the same place. And then we did those both before and after that experiment so we could do our inter-site comparisons so that we could basically make a statement that, yes, they were different in what's going on. I'll show you some fluxes. Again, because we do collect with eddy correlation, we do get both CO2 and water vapor fluxes, so we can begin to look at this piece. Again, here's a late August example. This is net radiation, water vapor fluxes, CO2 fluxes, and the soil heat flux and all of this. You get just the whole dynamic of what is going on. Much more typical of what we see, this is now the messier data where we now have that cloud cover buildup. Things are not always like California in the central part of the valley where it's really a nice greenhouse environment. The net radiation behaves very similar all the day. This becomes quite messy for us, as we'll see later on. And there you see that we do pick up a large amount of water vapor fluxes and CO2 fluxes. So I think that there are advantages of using some of the eddy correlation data into the models that we haven't used very appropriately yet, Ken, in terms of how do we begin to look at the real uptake of CO2 in this and aggregate it over time to begin to look and say, what is that real accumulation of biomass that's out there? And again, I just had to show you one perfect day of net radiation across central Iowa in terms of the dynamic of what's going on. But now I want to show you some real seasonal pieces of data out here. And this goes from just the planting until maturity of this crop. This happens to be corn. The upper line is net radiation. The gold line is latent heat flux. And then we have both sensible and soil heat fluxes in there. This happens to be 2011. You see that we have a large portion of that flux that's measured in the season, or earliest part of the season, is really sensible heat and latent heat. But you end up with these little spikes that occur, and if I can get that right there, post-rainfall event. So here's soil water evaporation that's occurring. You pick up these large spikes coming up. We also can pick up large spikes in evapotranspiration across large areas just by the producers tilling the field. And so you get all these different things. So you need to be very cognizant in the data set of really what's happened culturally within time series, because that management option of tilling that field, even the simple operation of planting that field, does cause a spike in evaporation going on, and we need to be able to interpret that. You also see then, as we go through that we're consuming most of that in terms of evaporation or latent heat of evaporation, and then as we dry that crop out at the end of the season. This is 2010 in soybeans, and the reason I put the 2010 data here is that 2010 was a wetter summer than 1993, and 1993 was the floods of the Midwest. There are two particular examples. 1993 was floods. 2012, everybody talks about the drought. 2010 was actually wetter in the summer than 1993. And so what we ended up with in these spikes, the downward spikes in that radiation, is extreme cloudy events in which we hardly had any input of energy into it. It rained. And you also see that there are places in evaporation that occurred late in the season in which we had low evaporation rates because all of a sudden we changed from a cool environment to an extremely hot, humid environment, and the plants didn't have the capability of taking that water up because the root zone was so confined. And so looking at that piece of the puzzle, 2010 corn, we saw the same thing in all of these dynamics that are going on. But I had to throw the drought here in. This is the 2012 piece, and if you look at this, 2012 is very, very important from a lot of different standpoints. It's actually one of our higher radiation values. We'll see more net radiation and more cumulative PAR during that season, about 25% more than a typical year across the Midwest. So a lot more energy input, a lot lower evaporation, a lot less of this dynamics that are going on because we just didn't have many rainstorms. And we see the same thing at corn. I expanded the scale up so you could see it. So we see a lot of these different pieces that are going on in this dynamic. And you see these pieces that are going on all the way through the season. But if we look at this, one of the major aspects is the variation of input. And if we start getting into rain-fed agriculture, one of these major differences that we have to account for both in time and space is precipitation. That upper line is 2010. That's that real wet year. The lower line is 2012, the dry year. And then we have 2011, 2012 in between that. 2013, we actually had a lot more rain early in the season. So you see entirely different dynamics. So it's very, very important in rain-fed agriculture to make sure that you have really adequate measures of rainfall input into this, because that's what's recharging this overall process. And so it has to be measured, and it needs to be measured near the site that's what you're doing, because we see large, in just like cloud cover, you can see large differences in cumulus rainfall events. Just to show you, here's a cumulative total going on. These are two different soils, different nitrogen rates that are going on that we've measured across the field, again, from planting until harvest out there. We need to understand that those soils really are a major limitation to the soil water evaporation rate, because that clarion soil just does not have the water to supply to meet the atmospheric demand that's out there. So it becomes water limited. So it goes back to this point that as experimentalists and everything, and we start working with crop modelers, we need to make sure that what we're supplying is appropriate in terms of the energy inputs and the uncertainties that go with that. What is the variation of net radiation that goes into that? What's the variation in temperature and vapor pressure in all of this? Ken made an excellent point, and I'll reinforce this, that it's not only air temperature that's different from weather stations that are out there, but the evaporating surface is often much cooler than air temperature as well, and so that changes it a bit. We measure canopy temperature routinely in all of our experiments, because we're interested in what that really is doing in terms of plant growth. The wind speed gradient and how we take that 2 meter air temp or 2 meter wind speed from a weather station and put it into what's over that canopy is entirely different as well. And then the soil water availability, it's really you need to characterize that spot that you're measuring within the field and to do that very accurately. If we think about the largest variables with variation are net radiation and solar, just because of the dynamics that go on in humid and rain-fed environments, precipitation both on and precipitation on a daily and an annual basis. Precipitation even more so on a daily basis because that's the input, and we really need to be very certain about that. Soil water holding capacity to really characterize what's going on in that particular soil within that particular part of the field that's out there. So it's very important from the standpoint, and we haven't talked about this, is the footprint of that system. What is that footprint of that system really representing out there? And we need to make sure that what we've measured in the soil is actually within the footprint of that system that we're looking at. And then now we get this whole aspect of partitioning between E and ET, or between E and T out there. Soil cover, canopy size, residue cover, all of those things influence that. And those become even more important in terms of how do we quantify the uncertainty in those things. And those become the more difficult parameters in all of this. Our challenges is that we really need to evaluate how robust crop models are in terms of the estimation of E and T under variable conditions. That's part of this whole effort that Ken's talking about. How are they really set up to be able to do this in lots of different ways, both in water-limited and water-unlimited environments? We're working on assembling these data sets across a wide variety of environments and crops because we really do need to be improving ET models. Garrett gave an actual example of this in terms of Georgia. We've done other ones for international projects looking at what's going to be required in terms of developing new lands and countries out there. And so there's a continual demand for ET and understanding water requirements and more importantly, where improvements can be made in water use efficiency. How can we more efficiently use the water into our cropping system? Because as we go forward, the major issue in a lot of this is going to be water. It's really water is going to become the dominant factor when we talk about climate change into the future, and it's really about water use in agriculture. So with that, I'll stop.
Gives very good answers to questions.
Yes.
For phytogenic inseminations or testing models, you need measurements, but in reality, there is a difference in terms of scale of simulation and measurements. For example, when you use a covariance in the field, and reference, the footprint is pretty large, while for simulation, we assume either a point or a field of a uniform.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if you start looking at the footprint of eddy correlation data, I mean, we're talking about 100 square meters, and you're now simulating almost a plant and figuring out its canopy. You know, you're going to assume that that model represents that particular area out there. But that's why I made the point relative to making sure that the soil piece of that was very, very appropriate for that, because that's a scaling parameter. You know, I can actually give you one data set that actually covers a 20 square mile footprint, because I have a tower on, or I have an eddy correlation system at 150 feet. So if you want a large footprint, you know, I can give you that as well. You know, but it really is there, and I think that's an appropriate question of how applicable are models, if you drive them with this, that represent large areas. One of the data sets we do have is that we actually have five eddy correlation systems within the same field as we go down a transect on the landscape. Then it would be very interesting to put that data against models to see really how well they represent in those dynamics. And I think that becomes a question. How do we scale? I mean, that when climate modelers are always asked to downscale, crop models are going to be, how do you have confidence in upscaling? You know, I mean, I really think that becomes an interesting question. And I can let Ken rebut that now, so. Or Garrett.
Okay, one more question. No?
Not good.
Thank you, Dr.